Stop the podcast.
Stop the podcast.
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV licensing.
Yes, TV licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
Despite it being July at the time of recording.
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watched The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 Weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids. Some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I gotta say. So I've been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I just, for me, I always, on television, watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton?
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 Weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.
Revered by fans during the 60s and the 70s, The Who were one of the most popular and influential rock groups of two, at least, decades. Revered by fans, they became a world-class act, securing their longevity with sensational live performances and pioneering music. One man has put that all down. That man is Mike Evans, who's written a book, The Who, Much Too Much. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the UK. Mike himself. Mike, good afternoon to you.
Hello, hi.
Good to have you with us. The Who, I mean, they are one of the most successful rock outfits ever, but they moved with the times. They changed from the early days.
Yeah, they did. They started off as a normal straight R&B band. It was in the English rhythm and blues boom in the mid, not quite mid-60s, kind of 63, 64, that kind of time. And they were a straight R&B band, really, playing sort of Muddy Waters numbers and that kind of stuff. But they soon soon found their own style, which was more in tune with an emerging kind of what would be considered a sort of mod sort of ethos into the middle of the decade, which is reflected in, I suppose, first of all, with a kind of American modern R&B, which is by then called soul music, and from that they developed their own style, which again was a forerunner of punk and, on one hand, and electronic kind of excess on the other, and they hugely influential.
I mean, the thing is, when were they originally called? Was it the Detours originally, the original name for the band?
That's right, yeah, they had a band called The Detours, which was Townsend and Roger Daltrey and John Entwistle and a drummer who quickly got the heave-ho. And they thrashed about without a regular drummer for a while until Keith Moon introduced himself. And it was at that point that Pete Townsend was later quoted as saying that suddenly we weren't playing games anymore. We realised this was it. And the jigsaw was the last piece in the jigsaw was Keith Moon. And so they were called The Detours, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned that sort of sensibility. They changed to becoming sort of more sort of soul influence. So, while the Stones were off doing their thing, they were more, The Who were more influenced by sort of pop art and style as well as substance.
Well, that's right. There's a lot of visual aspect to it. I mean, famously, there was Pete Townsend smashing up his guitars on stage, which he said was influenced by his art school lecturer, which is a guy called Gustav Metzger. This is at Ealing College of Art. But the other great influence in terms of visual art was pop art, which kind of appropriated popular sort of symbols like Union Jack flags and so on. And
talking of the Who with Mike Evans. Mike, you dropped out there for a second. Do you think that the Who were ready for the huge success that was you know, the first hit single, My Generation? Hello? We're having one of those days, are we? Let me try this again. Hello, Mike, can you hear me?
Hello, yeah. What was all that?
Who knows? Some intergalactic stuff. I was just going to say, do you think that the Who were ready for the success from the off? I mean, they seem to be, despite sort of Moon's antics, they were an intelligent band.
Oh, yeah, very much so. And Pete Townsend in particular had a sort of vision, or a series of visions, if you like, of ambitions and dreams that, along artistic lines, which produced the very, very inventive sort of flow into the music. Roger Daltrey had the more, if you like, normal ambitions of any aspiring rock singer. He wanted to be rich and famous, which was nothing wrong with that. And Entwistle was, in fact, probably the most schooled musician of the four. He actually grew up in a musical family, well, as did Pete, but he was actually encouraged in what one would call serious music and was in a local youth orchestra, symphony orchestra, when he was 12 year old or something, playing a French horn. So he was quite a school musician. So the combination of those four thrusts, along with Keith Moon's chaotic but undisciplined but hugely technically superb drumming, the combination of all those things kind of made them very very creative from start.
And I mean, one of the things that people always talk about is the live performance, because whilst other people perhaps were sort of twiddling away and doing 18-hour guitar solos, I've heard it described as maximum R&B. I mean, they really were a power unit.
Well, that's right. And as you say, as the 60s progressed, if that's the right word, a lot of rock groups got more and more self-indulgent, let's put it that way, with you know, 20-minute guitar solos and 20-minute drum solos and so on. Whereas the Who were always really tight, probably like the Beatles. They never, very rarely made album tracks, for instance, that were overindulgent. Even when Pete Townsend had ambitious ideas like rock operas and things, the actual content, the actual tunes were very accessible and memorable, and hence them coming out as singles, you know, as were most of the Beatles' output. There was nothing overindulgent about it.
And one of the other things, I mean, people tend to forget, but The Who, correct me if I'm wrong, they played Woodstock, didn't they?
Oh yeah, very much so. in a memorable fashion, because they confessed very soon afterwards that they hated the whole scene, and they didn't have a lot of much sympathy for the kind of hippie ethos. And famously, when Abbie Hoffman, who was a kind of political hippie activist, leapt on the stage and started ranting for the release of one of his fellow activists, Townsend physically kicked him off the stage and said, get off my expletive stage. but they they played Woodstock and cut quite a huge impression.
And then, of course, there were the albums. I mean, Who's Next, which we celebrated, difficult to believe, but it's 50 years ago it came out. I mean, what an album. I mean, absolutely, for me, defines the early 70s.
Yes, yeah. Who's Next, and of course, because that had followed on from Tommy, which was the extravagant rock opera that had set them onto a different plane. It's interesting that their career, for instance, in America, they never really broke through that big, even though they had hits there, until Tommy, and that put them on a whole different level. And at the same time, as if to establish that they weren't going into the dangerous overindulgence territory of prog rock, they put out a live album known as Live at Leeds, which in a way was put the record straight that this was their live set, this was them playing straight ahead rhythm and blues, and a lot of cover, you know, half of the album was covers. So as much as to say, well, you know, Tommy's one thing, but we're also a straight rock band of a more perhaps modest.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that always gets voted when they come out for sort of best live albums ever, I mean, Live at Leeds is always in the top five there or thereabouts. It's interesting with Tommy, though, because although it may have been a concept album, I mean, it was full of great tracks. It wasn't a long and rambling, you know, rambling sort of dissertation on the life of man.
No, exactly. That's as I said. It was never unaccessible. There were hits in there, Pinball Wizard, etc., I'm a Boy, and there was a whole load of stuff in there that was that did or could have quite successfully just been put out as a single and made the charts, and some of them did, of course. So there was never fell into that prog rock trap that was developing at the end of the 60s.
Obviously, by the mid-70s, they're a huge band, they're touring. Some of the excesses are becoming sort of in-jokes, if you like, especially of Moon. And then, of course, he passes away suddenly. And for many bands, that would have been it. It was certainly it for Led Zeppelin. But they regroup.
That's right, yeah. When Keith died, obviously it was a huge traumatic moment for the band. And they eventually recruited Kenny Jones, who'd been with the Small Faces and then Rod Stewart's Faces. They, funnily enough, when they were made it known that they were looking for a new drummer, Phil Collins, who wasn't doing much at the time, actually offered his services. and Townsend turned him down because he already had his eye on Kenny Jones. And Kenny Jones, interestingly, fine, great drummer. Interestingly said that if he'd been given the choice, he'd rather have not got the job if it meant that Keith was back there playing, you know. And he was with him for a couple of albums, yeah, and he's a fine drummer, yeah.
But obviously it was difficult to fill those shoes. What were the 80s like? I mean, again, you know, the rhythm section, I mean, Entwistle and Moon worked together, and then suddenly Entwistle was gone as well. And for lots of people, that definitely would have been it.
Yeah, Entwistle died in the early 2000s, 2002. That's quite right. That the gap that they left, things shifted slightly. But Townsend and Daltrey were very clever to retain the, if you like, the spirit of the Who and the kind of onstage dynamic of it, even though they were introducing different musicians and with slightly different techniques and so on around it. And as time progressed, obviously they made less and less albums, so their main impact was as a live band, where they were able to recruit a variety of people who were just what you might call session men. They weren't with the band on a regular basis, because they'd be doing, you know, one tour a year, even if that.
Yeah.
And some of their albums were few and far between. I mean, after 1982, they didn't make another album till 2006. Then after studio album, and then after 2006, they didn't make a studio album till the last one, 2019. So it was more their impetus on the road that seemed to get them going, and that relied on a variety of great musicians. They weren't particularly a four-piece anymore. They had, you know, all sorts of accompanists.
So why did you decide that the time was right to do this book, and where did you start? I mean, how did you get all the information together?
The time seemed right because, well, nobody, we didn't know the pandemic was going to happen. But that album, Who, which they released in 2019, seemed, I mean, when they made that, you know, Townsend 76 or something, 75, and Daltrey a year or so older than him. So it seemed like if they were going to make a final album, this might be it. So obviously, you know, never say never. But and it seemed time to look at their whole body of work, which by that time went back to 65. So it's a good half century. And then, of course, when the pandemic came, it made it even more pertinent to get on with it. And I had discussions with the publisher, and we decided that the time was right, and that was my lockdown moment.
And what's it like going through going through all of all the albums, going through archive interviews as well, from the time, and also picking out some of the the favourite tracks, dissecting the tracks, and also getting some pictures together.
Yeah, well, the pictures with these kind of books are often the hard work is done by a picture researcher, and the author tends to guide them in what's needed. So you might have to have a picture from that gig or a picture from this gig or whatever, and a picture researcher will do the hard nosed job of finding them. Of course, you there's a lot of guidance from the author, in as much as I know where a lot of pictures have been seen before or where they haven't, or which magazine I remember seeing it in or whatever. And I have to admit that life on that research level is a lot easier since the internet, because when I started writing books of this kind, there was a lot more time spent in libraries and amongst my own fairly vast collection of music reference books and magazines and so on. And there's still a lot of that you have to do, obviously, but the internet does make some aspects of it easier. But yes, we decided the time was right, and I was confident that I had enough material either at my fingertips or I knew where to find it, we got on with it.
And it must be sort of fascinating to go through and see the evolution of the band from that R&B through the mod movement into a brief flirtation with hippies, then the concept albums plus the live stuff, and then obviously from the mid-70s through to the present day.
Yeah, that's right. And it's interesting because Townsend, again, as the main creative driving force, it has to be said, came up with all sorts of ambitious experiments, some of which were more successful than others, but he was able to indulge himself in them, but not in the way that was overindulgent and pretentious, in the sense that he did it in the context of the band rather than the other way around. The band wasn't doing stuff in the context of Pete Townsend's flights of fancy,
right.
But it was the other way around, that his flights of fancy were created within the context of the band. So it was very interesting and made it always very, very accessible.
I mean, do you think that the Who are sort of somewhat overlooked and perhaps sort of not given the importance that they deserve?
Well, I think that there was always a kind of hierarchy of UK bands, of the rock bands, of which obviously it was always accepted. You're looking at the Beatles, the Stones, and then who's the third? Was it the Who, or was it Led Zeppelin, or was it whatever? There was always this kind of acceptance that the Beatles and the Stones, the Beatles because of their influence, because they would certainly didn't make far less, because they were only going for effectively for 8 years as recording group, and so they didn't make that many albums, studio albums, and very few live albums. The Stones made a lot more albums, and obviously, like the Who, have been going in one form or another for the last 50, nearly 60 years. But those two, for a variety of reasons, were always considered the two, and then there was who was the third. But I reckon fairly safely you could say it was the Who.
Indeed. The book is called The Who, Much Too Much. It's by Mike Evans, who we've been chatting to today. Mike, if people want to find out more information about the book or about you, do you have a website? Can they find you on one of the social medias?
No, I don't do social media, funnily enough. anymore, for quite deliberate reasons, which I won't go into now. Obviously, the details about the book or similar books by the publisher, which is Palazzo, is on palazzoeditions.com. Palazzoeditions, one word, .com. And there's some information there about me. And obviously, you can go on to websites and find other books I've written and just by googling Mike Evans.
Who's next in your sights then for a book after The Who?
Sorry? Who's next in line? I'm not sure at the moment. I'm toying with two or three ideas which I shouldn't really tell you because they're bright ideas, but we hope they're bright ideas. No, I'm talking about two or three things at the moment that we hope to get off the ground in the next few months. And these things take a long time, you know. I mean, that book was, as I say, it was it started before the pandemic. So you know, we're talking about 18 months, 2 years.
Well, it's 18 months, 2 years well spent. The book is called The Who, Much Too Much. It's by Mike Evans, who we've been chatting to today. Mike, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Giles. A pleasure.
Stop the podcast.
Stop the podcast.
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV licensing.
Yes, TV licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
Despite it being July at the time of recording.
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watched The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 Weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids. Some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I gotta say. So I've been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I just, for me, I always, on television, watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton?
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 Weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.